And you're very welcome back to the Greg Hughes podcast. Well, what does it take to become the trusted confidant to some of the world's most powerful, wealthy, and famous icons? Today's guest didn't just watch 20th century history from the sidelines, he was the ultimate insider. From the majestic halls of Glenveagh Castle to the exclusive social circles of Philadelphia, Salzburg, and Hawaii, Patrick Gallagher held the keys to a golden age of glamour. This is a man who kept Greta Garbo's secrets, shared quiet moments with Hollywood royalty, rubbed shoulders with the aristocracy, and jet-setted across the globe on Concorde. He didn't just witness this exclusive world, he lived it, ran it, and came home with the stories to prove it. Let's step inside his world. Here is the legendary Donegal man, Patrick Gallagher. Now, our guest on the podcast is someone I'm really genuinely delighted to welcome onto it. It is Patrick Gallagher. Patrick, you're not an unfamiliar voice to Highland Radio. You would have spoken to my predecessor over the years, Sean Doherty, I imagine.
Yes, I've spoken to Sean Doherty over 20 years ago.
Right. Well, here we are now. Born in 1937 in Dunluce. Just paint a picture of your early years in Dunluce for me.
Well, Dunluce was a very backward area, very primitive. We didn't have any facilities. We just had the national school where I went to from the years 1941 to 51. We didn't have a high school, so that was my only education, what I got in Dunluce.
And was it a case that it just wasn't an option for the family for you to travel to third level, or it just wasn't the done thing at the time?
Well, the nearest secondary school was St. Eunan's in Letterkenny.
Yeah.
There wasn't any in Valcarra, Gweedore, or anywhere in between. So unless you got a scholarship, people couldn't afford to send you to Letterkenny. Anyhow, there was no transportation.
That's right. And in fact, a guest coming up on a future podcast would be Dinny McGinley, and he was able to pursue his education as a school teacher through the likes of one of those scholarships. And they were not easy got either. They were hard to get.
Yes, of course they were. But there were some teachers who gave certain children who were bright, special tutoring, like Dinny McGinley and my own two brothers, Huey and Micheál. They went to secondary school. Huey went to St. Eunan's and Micheál went to St. Enda's in Galway.
No such encouragement for you, or me for that matter.
I wasn't interested in going. That was the main reason.
You never travelled, or did you travel early? Because you started work in Glenveagh quite young, 1954. So that's what, 17, around about that age. So
this is exactly 17.
Yeah. So you stuck around West Donegal. You stuck around Dunluce.
I did. Did odd jobs, going to the bog, helping on the little farm at home with the sheep. And
you're happy enough?
I didn't know anything different.
Yeah. Okay, and was there a family business to go into, or were your family into agriculture or any other business, or?
My father was a small farmer.
He yeah,
had 5 acres, and he went to Scotland every winter because there was no way of making money.
So even him, the generation that went before you, to pay the bills, he had to head to Scotland in the cold dark months.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. You mentioned two brothers. Was there just three siblings in the house?
No, there were seven in all. I had four brothers and two sisters. One sister died in 1941. She was just 2 and a half.
So how did you then come to take up a job in Glenveagh?
Well, that happened because the owner of Glenveagh bought the Dunluce estate in 1943. The estate that's owned by the Guinnesses now. And he bought it when he was in the Navy, and he was on the Bunker Hill in the South Pacific fighting the Japanese. And the Dunluce estate came on the market, and a solicitor from Milford, who was a man called Mr. Osborne, sent him a telegram that he should buy Dunleavy to protect his, as he called it, his western flank.
And from there, you because you weren't the only family member working in there, were you?
Well, McInerney sent back a telegram to Osborne to buy Dunleavy, just a two-word telegram.
Wow.
Which he bought for $3,500 in 1943. Then after buying it, he didn't know what to do with it. So when he returned to Ireland after the war in 1946, he decided to fix up Dunleavy because it was in pretty bad shape. And he thought it'd be a nice place for his sister and her family. And he was in Dunleavy in 1946, and they were looking for extra help in Glenveagh. And the housekeeper got to meet my sister, Nellie. She hired her in 1946, and she went to work there and was there until Mr. Mackley left Glenveagh in 83. So that was my connection to get into Glenveagh.
And your brother Dermot was also there. Was that before you or after you?
That was after me. He came in 59 because he had been working in Scotland. And he came as a chauffeur in 1959 when the previous chauffeur left, a man called Sandy Stafford.
Mm. So there was Nellie, then Patrick, and then Dermot eventually, and all three of you working there at the same time.
And Huey and Michael worked there summers while they were home from college in the early 50s.
So early on, what was your job there? Because, I mean, you're going in there 17 years of age, okay? So you had to earn your stripes too, presumably, as we had to in the past. Nothing was handed to you, right? What was your early jobs there?
Well, I was classified as a second footman. I did the fires, maintained the hot water boiler, you know, built it with turf. And we didn't call it the hot water boiler, we called it the donkey. And I had to keep fires going from about 8 o'clock in the morning and four public rooms, the dining room, the study, the drawing room, and the music room. And also kept the lamps all in shape. We didn't have any electricity then. Glenveagh didn't get electric power until 1959. So from my time, from 54 to 59, it was oil lamps and tilly lamps. Have you ever heard of tilly lamps?
Are they not paraffin, no?
Oh, they were paraffin, but they were...
That's the shape of them?
No, they were sort of a vaporizing system with a mantle on them.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't have been used in only in the rear end of the house, in the kitchen and the pantry and all. But they give a better light.
Yeah.
They came on the market sometime around 1949 until the electric came in 59.
It must have been quiet. You know, the one thing about modern life, there's always noise, you know, generated by electronics or whatever it might be. It must have been a peaceful place to work, you know, with just the...
Oh, there were certainly no noises. We did have two refrigerators, two American ones. They were up run by paraffin oil.
Right.
They were imported in the late 40s. And they were made by a company called Kelvinator. And that was another chore I had to do to fill those tanks once a week. Also, I had to clean shoes for the guests and carry luggage to their bedrooms and whatever other odd jobs had to be done.
And were these sort of highfalutin fancy people that would have been landing or...?
Well, they were all grand society people, right. Mostly. Very, very... nice people to talk to.
And they were nice to you?
Oh, people who are well educated and are rich are the nicest people to talk to, yes.
Okay. What about the tips?
Tips were very good in Glenveagh, because when I started in Glenveagh, I was making £3 a week.
Mm. Now, 1960, that's sort of, what, 6-7 years after you first began there, you, I suppose, moved up, did you? Well, was that how you would see it?
The man who was the first footman, he went off to Scotland in 1956, so I moved up to his position. That meant helping the butler serve meals and setting the dining room tables and the breakfast trays for the ladies.
But this would have been all stuff you had observed over your time. So did it come relatively easy to you?
The next stage, yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, of course, you were there watching what was going on. And also we had to clean the silver every day, whatever was used.
Now, imagine that. Yeah, you talked about sort of high society. You know, what kind of names or of note would have came through the doors, say, in the 50s into the 60s? I'm just curious as what kind of people may have sort of visited the...
Well, Mr. Mackinley used to always come to Glenveagh by way of London. He, in the early years, he may have flown directly into Ireland. But literally, he always stayed in London a week and he would meet people there, been invited to parties, and he would say to them, well, if you're in Ireland this summer, look me up and come and visit.
And this would have just been heaven on earth to these people.
They were usually people, titled people, lords and ladies. Let's say the Duchess of Westminster would be one person who would come on a regular basis. Lady Diana's father came, Lord Spencer.
And where were they staying? So what was the building? Just explain the layout. Where they would have been coming to visit Dunluce. Beg your pardon, Glenveagh. So the Glenveagh, I'm just trying to paint the picture for listeners here. So the Glenveagh that we're familiar with now was in that building, that house. Is that where you were working?
That hasn't changed anything. The layout of it hasn't changed anything.
But the thing is because it's kind of open to the public between different events, you know, many people listening to this will be familiar with the layout and the beauty and grandeur of it.
Well, it had about 12 guest bedrooms. You know, some were single, but mostly were doubles. So he would organize his weekend parties around the inviting a couple or inviting single people. And he liked to mix American guests with the English ones. He said it made for better conversation.
And was this just to satisfy his own social desires?
Yes.
There was no ulterior motive.
It was like a free hotel. Yeah.
And we'll get through some of the names at the moment, but some of these are the who's who of you know, the social circles, the media, etc. Would there have been local knowledge that Ian Fleming, the man behind James Bond, was in town?
No, nobody would have known who he was or never wouldn't have heard about it or they wouldn't have known who was at Glenveagh.
Which is quite remarkable. Were you instructed to keep it quiet or was there just no public hunger for the information?
Ian Fleming wouldn't have been well known as a writer then.
Mm.
He came in the early sort of 54, 56, around that time.
And what was he like?
Well, he was just an unassuming man, very quiet. I didn't know who he was. I never heard of him before.
Nor were you interested, probably. Were you?
Well, no, he was just another guest. I didn't know who Ian Fleming was. I didn't even know that he had written a book. I think he only had one book published by that time.
Yeah, probably The Living Daylights, I think. Was that his first one? I'm not quite sure. Moving on to, so he was there 54, 55. Henry Fonda and his daughter Jane Fonda. I mean, two massive heavy hitters. Like, I'm trying to think of, for those listening who might be of younger age, this is like, you know, effectively Taylor Swift landing in Glenveagh or you know, Katy Perry and Mr. Trudeau. Like, these were massive at the time. They both arrived at the same time, did they? Again, I'm going to get the impression that you are going to find these people pretty unassuming and just nice people, right?
We wouldn't have known who they were
because
there was no social media in those days and we didn't have any television. Glenveagh was the worst place in the world, even though we got electric in 59. The television signal at Glenveagh was hopeless. We never watched television.
Yes. Just to give listeners and viewers an idea of who else was there, John Houston. I mean, there's people from all over the country that go down to visit where The Quiet Man was made. The man who directed that was up here.
He was up there
as well.
Here with his wife, Ricky Houston. They had a castle in Galway at the time.
Greta Garbo, again, another huge international star.
Yes, that was people knew who she was. But she didn't want to meet anyone or talk to anyone.
Did she turn your eye, turn your head? Was she a beautiful woman?
Oh, she was. Oh, well, I talked to her quite a bit. She would ask who these people were when they would have guests. She came when she was about 70 years old, 19.
But she came because of her celebrity kind of transcended. She used an alias, didn't she? She would she be one of the few celebrities that used a pseudonym? Miss Grace, I think she came out.
And that was when I was booking into the Royal Hibernian Hotel in Dublin.
Uh-huh.
She told me not to give her name, so I called her Miss Grace.
Did you come up with them?
I came up with that name, yes. Now, she came with an art dealer called Samuel Green. She was very interested in art and had bought a lot of art over the years. So she came with Samuel Green, and she spent 10 days there. And I have a picture of her that, but the back of her head, you could never get a picture of the front of her.
Okay, but it's still a wonderful thing. Lord Mountbatten too, he was familiar. He's kind of was, you know, he was kind of more a familiar face around Donegal Town, but also a visitor too.
He didn't come as a, didn't stay overnight. He came with a party for a lunch party, but they came when Mr. Mackley wasn't in residence. So I was given the job at showing them around and let them use the dining room for their picnic lunch.
So you were the face of the home for that visit?
Yes, and showed them around the house. And he kept asking me, was I in the Royal Navy? 3 times he asked me that question. I don't know why he thought I should be in the Royal Navy.
Yeah. Did that talk to the regard that you were held in, that they thought that, and why wouldn't they, but they thought that this young man from Dunluce held himself so well that he could represent the house, that he could be the welcoming party effectively for a lord?
Well, I assume so, yes.
Mm. I don't think you're too assuming, though. You're quite an unassuming person, are you?
Very much so, yes.
In terms of your own self.
Mr. Mackley went to stay at Lord Mountbatten's place in Classybone 2 weeks before the boat was blown up, and he was out on that particular boat.
Wow.
It was a usual thing on a Saturday morning for the guests to go out to pick up the lobster pots. And he was there. He was there for the weekend. And I was with him in Salzburg when we got the word that Mountbatten was killed.
How did that affect you? And not politically or personally, but this was someone that you'd spent time with. You know, how did that affect you?
Well, it was a great shock to everybody and to Mackley, especially because he had been in the house and on the boat 2 weeks previous.
And of course, whom the people responsible would have been tracking movements. So that could have happened at any time when they, you know, they would have seen the familiarity with the pattern. Who's to say it couldn't have happened a couple of weeks earlier?
Of course it could have, yes.
Mm. You also were nearly ambushed in Tyrone. You were telling Caroline Orr, who researches this, twice. What's the backstory to that? It's both in Armagh and Tyrone. What happened there?
Well, it was the early days of the Troubles. First was in coming from Dublin on a road from Dundalk going to Monaghan. You go through a couple of miles in County Armagh that you weren't allowed to stop. And this car tried to cut me off and stop me and tried to, you know, pull me into the side of the road, but I just kept on going. And kept blowing the horn and waving me down. I don't know what purpose. But it was dark at night in the month of October, and I just kept going.
You were glad to get home that night?
Glad to get home, very much so. But then it happened in daylight, about 2 years later with the Glenveagh minivan, which was a time that there were... I don't know who it was, the IRA or whoever, were taking over vehicles and putting bombs into them, making you drive to a designated spot. And if you had a passenger on, they would hold the passenger until you delivered your load. And they tried to stop me outside Oma, between Oma and Newton Stewart. I was in a group of cars, and this car came up and kind of got me separated. And they got me into a little lay-by. When I realised the guy was opening the back door with a machine gun, I just went out past him.
Close shave, that one.
Yes, my sister was on
Wow.
Nelly, and she was yelling at me that I should stop. And I said, no, stop, we're doomed.
So theoretically, presumably, they saw the van. You say it was a minivan. They says, right, this will accommodate whatever we want to put in it. And you would effectively, presumably, they would have kept Nelly until such time as you dropped this van off. Such was the modus operandi at that time.
That was exactly it, yes.
Unbelievable stuff. Again, to go through some of the people you've met on and on, Helen Hayes, she was in Airport 1 and 2, which is a bit of a random one.
Yes.
Comedic actress, what was she like?
Well, she was a wonderful character. She came in the 50s and stayed at Glenveagh. She was there at least twice, sort of 50. She was there the first year I was there in 54. She came again in 56. And McAlee took her into the local pub in Termon. It's called Rosie McKay's. Now it's called the Glenveagh Inn.
Mm.
And Rosie was a character with an old-fashioned bar. Went in there in the afternoon and got a bottle of whiskey and ordered a bottle of whiskey and had a drink.
You talked about, you know, the Troubles and the time of the Troubles. And, you know, this was a gentleman who was well connected in England. Princess Margaret was over, presumably.
Princess Margaret didn't come to Glenveagh.
Oh, right.
She
went to Philadelphia. That's right. OK, my mistake. But in any case, you know, you had the lords and the gentry and the rich and the good from Britain. Political tensions were rising at the time. Was there any concerns about security at Glenveagh or the fact that, you know, it could have a target on its back for the...
Well, there was. And that's why we had a night watchman from the time of the Troubles started.
Yeah.
We didn't have any security up until that point.
Mm.
But Mr. McAlee himself never felt threatened as an American. But it was inconvenient going back and forth to Belfast Airport, because that's the airport we used all the time.
Mm.
Going to London and for guests coming in. And sometimes they were delayed by the Troubles, you know, coming through Derry, and you know, it wasn't easy in those days.
You talked about your time in America, and again, you know, this is where you probably engage more with royalty. You know, when was that and how did you find yourself out there?
Princess Margaret came in 1973 for dinner, a huge dinner party. We had 80 people.
This was in America?
In America.
So what were you doing out there in the first instance?
Well, I went to work with McAlee as his butler. I mean, I was the butler of Glenveagh in 1960. And from then on, I travelled back and forth with McAlee for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
The summers in Glenveagh and the winters in Philadelphia as his
butler. Did you see that as a fantastic opportunity? Did you have to think twice about it? Or was this a way for you to see the world?
Didn't think too much about it. It was just came naturally.
Mm.
But I was there all through the 60s. And 1970, Princess Margaret was coming to America and he invited her for dinner with Lord Snowden. And it was quite a big occasion because we had to have all the people who worked there vetted by the FBI and the British
Secret Security Service and all those people.
And to get everybody's passport and their date of birth, and it was kind of sort of embarrassing in a way to ask all these older help, because we had to hire private help. We didn't have a caterer.
Yeah.
And they all agreed, give me their dates of birth and their passports.
It's hard to get a read on you, Patrick, right? Because, you know, your story is absolutely fascinating. And for any other person, most other people, you know, this, you talk of your life and your life experiences so casually as if, well, you know what? Yeah, I traveled around with him all over the place and met this person and that person. Is that just in time, or were you always like that? That it was like, you know, I can do this. I can do whatever I like. I'm the same as anybody else. It's just whatever.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah.
Do you think that's what made you perfect for the job then? Because you're not going to be starstruck. You're not going to be the best you got so far as a picture of the back of someone's head. So you obviously weren't incredibly intrusive. Is that why do you think that you were seen as such an asset?
Well, you weren't meant to be intrusive as a butler. You were always in the background.
Yeah.
You were always there when you were needed.
But conversations, you must have heard some stuff.
Oh, the intelligent conversation was unbelievable. What these people talked about.
Yeah.
one thing they never talked about was money.
Right. But politics, security, you know, do you have an insight into, you know, what Princess Margaret thought of the her family or the British public or the world at that time? Or did you switch off to it?
Well, she wouldn't get involved in anything like that and been in a foreign country.
Too clever.
To be always something to do with the arts or where they had been or where they had travelled.
So it's like a pub. You don't discuss religion or politics. Is that it? It's kind of like
that.
That's
the theory, yes. Yeah. It doesn't happen always in the pubs.
No, of course it doesn't. That's why there's so much security on pub doors nowadays. Yeah. So also to this, is it a relationship with the Spencers that was formed? Princess Diana, of course, who's incredibly and was incredibly popular in this country. Her popularity transcends, not with everyone, but for many people. Her dad, Earl Spencer, your travel with him or your service of him or however you want to describe it was a bit more personal than some of the people we've been talking to up until now. Talk to me about that.
About Lord Spencer?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he came to Philadelphia with his wife, but Mr. Macklin was a friend of the wife before Lord Spencer married her. She was the second wife. And they came and stayed at Philadelphia for 4 days. And she was very interested in the art museum, the art, whereas he was interested in Victorian buildings. And she went with Mr. Macklin on the limousine to the museum, and he wanted to get a second limousine to take Lord Spencer around the city to view or to photograph Victorian buildings. And there was some mix-up anyway, and the limousine didn't show up. So I said to him, I'd take him in my little Opel Manta that I had, which I still haven't brought it over here.
Yeah.
And he said that was fine. He didn't mind what he...
So you're in the driver's seat. He's in the passenger seat.
Yeah. And he gave me a list of the buildings that he'd like to see. One was, he wanted to see the art museum on the outside, not the
wasn't
art inside.
Wasn't interested in the inside, yeah.
And he wanted to see City Hall. And there were several churches that he wanted to see. And we got around them all.
So it's a whistle-stop tour in the Manta.
Whistle-stop tour of Philadelphia and the Manta.
And why did you take it back over with you? What was the personal connection? Because that's not easy. It has to be taken to the port. It has to be put in a container. It has to be over. It has to be cleared. Why the Manta? Why did the Manta have to come home with you?
Oh, I brought over several cars over the years.
Okay, but so you had four.
Manta was one, but it's not a big deal. You just
It is a big deal.
I took it to. I put that one in a container.
Yeah.
And it came in by way of Dublin, and I cleared it through the customs there and got it registered here. And I have it here, and I take it to car shows.
Yes. But do you associate that trip with Earl Spencer with the car, or do you just love the metal and the rubber and the smell? Like, is it a sentimental connection, or just the fact that it's a lovely old car?
Oh, it's because it's an Opel Manta.
Yeah.
Because they're rather rare now. Not too many of them around.
They certainly are. So, did you attend the wedding of Charles and Lady Diana, and was that as an accompaniment to Mr. McElhinney, or how did that work?
Well, Mr. McElhinney was one of two Americans invited to the wedding. He and Mrs. Mellon from Pittsburgh. If you know what Pittsburgh Steel is, she was one of that. No, Pittsburgh's plate glass. She was. And he was invited to the wedding. And I went to London to be with him. Brought over his bowler hat because I carried it from America. And we stayed at the Berkeley Hotel. So the morning of the wedding, of course, he had his own limousine in London. So I travelled with him on the royal route, Buckingham Palace to where the wedding was in St. Paul's. And then let Mr. McInerney out to go to the church. And I asked the chauffeur where would be a good spot to watch. And he says, right across there on the steps of the Old Bailey, he said, the courthouse. That's where I watched the Royal Wedding.
Fantastic. Program. And were you interested in it, or was it just another day in the office?
I was very interested, yes.
But your meeting with Spencer was after that, wasn't it? That was the following year, so that was almost a coincidence, was it?
Well, no, I had met Lord Spencer before the wedding,
right.
Yes.
It predated that.
But again, I met them afterwards.
So, of all the people that you have met, and we haven't even really scratched the surface of those, is there any that stand out for you, or that were special for you, or is your go-to story, you know, about your life experience, or are they just all regular folk to you? Like, who did anyone meet you and you were in awe of them, or?
Well, there were so many, I guess. I met Mrs. Kennedy. She came for, she came for tea once. She met Siobhan here very much. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that day?
No.
You don't? She came with her niece, Maria Schreiber.
This is Donegal? Oh, Philadelphia.
No, in Philadelphia. Okay. No, she was never in Donegal. Yeah. She was in Ireland, but she was never in Donegal. With,
yeah.
Not with Mr. McInerney. But there were so many people, like Andy Warhol was a character to have met.
Yes, he, an artist, and artists can be a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
So what was he like?
He was born in Pittsburgh. He was, I guess, Polish background. Very strange. He came with his whole entourage once to McInerney's, and they made a movie called The Chelsea Girls. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, of course I have. Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
And they stayed the weekend. Oh, no, stayed about 5 days. But he was quite a character. I liked him.
Yeah, okay, good stuff. And like a lot of his art is well renowned, but I see here, because you can recognize Andy Warhol's work a mile away, right? Am I correct saying he did the Campbell's soup?
He did the Campbell's soup, and that was the most sort of outstanding one.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he was prepared to go commercial as well if the money was there.
Yeah. But he had this nightclub in New York called the Factory. All kinds of stuff went on there.
Mm.
Another man came to stay at Glen Irwin McInerney's in Philadelphia was Truman Capote.
Not a name I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
Truman Capote.
He was a writer.
Oh, well, that explains it. I'm not a great reader. Okay.
He wrote the one, it's called In Cold Blood.
Right.
Very interesting book. And another gentleman used to come was Tennessee Williams.
That's a streetcar named Desire, isn't it?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. And a cat in the hat. These were incredibly influential people. But just in relation to them, and I'm not in any way trying to denigrate McInerney's memory in any way, shape or form, but was he a very interesting character? Was he fascinating? Was he well connected and people wanted to be around him? Or did he use, you know, his wealth and it was he that wanted to be sort of in the company of these people?
Oh, no, you got it right what you said and how you explained it, yes. He liked to have those people around him. He almost did in the background, but he liked to get them together and mix people like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, and we see that now a lot. So in other words, like, and I'm sure he formed friendships, but, you know, Tennessee Williams wasn't saying per se, geez, I really need to go and see this guy. He's a great mate of mine. Or maybe he was. I don't know.
Well, it'd be in the Philadelphia area and there would be correspondence to say, well, if you're ever in the area, come and visit me or to be arranged.
You are in a small club of people that are from Donegal, I'm guessing, that have flown on Concorde twice. No one can do that now. Concorde was retired not so long ago. Well, quite some time ago, actually. Sorry, I forgot how old I am.
Yeah.
81. It's remarkable, right? You could fly, you know, from Heathrow to JFK or wherever in the distance it would take you to watch a streetcar named Desire.
Correct, yeah.
He knows it.
Well, I've flown twice from JFK to London, not the other way around. And from takeoff and at JFK to you landed in Heathrow, just under the 3.5 hours.
Astonishing stuff, isn't it? And with your association as well, I mean, you know, we've talked about Philly, we talked about Donegal, Glenveagh, But I mean, you over the course of your time, you spent time in Austria. Where else were you? Hawaii for 6 weeks a year. You know, was there much downtime, or were you on the clock all of the time?
Yeah, time didn't sort of matter. You know, you worked whatever, 7 days a week sometimes. You didn't think of it. Mm. But there was enough downtime, you know, when Mr. Mackney was away without me. We went to Austria to the Salzburg Music Festival. I remember picking up Pavarotti once at the hotel.
Oh, wow.
And I had no idea who he was. He was a young man then.
You weren't in the Opel then picking him up. He was a big guy, wasn't he? He was a tall guy.
Well, I was in a BMW we had rented. So I went down to pick him up and brought him up. Mr. Mackley used to rent a house up in the mountains above Salzburg. And he said, pick up this man at the Golden Hirsch. And he gave me his name, but it meant nothing to me because he was quite a young man. He was just making his sort of start in the opera world. And I picked him up and took him for lunch, and he didn't speak English. And we had no conversation on the way up.
No, I can imagine. So was he on his own?
He was on his own, yes. Okay, yeah.
So some other people that you've met, Doris Duke, who's more in society through being a heiress to the tobacco millionaire, Bruce Springsteen, right, who's an absolute legend, a living legend here. By the reads of things here, though, he's only just about living after his encounter with you. Well, I exaggerate slightly, right? So what happened?
That was in more recent years. Mr. Mackley never met Bruce Springsteen. Okay. No, I went to Florida with another family I worked for after Mr. Mackley passed away in 86. And I went to Florida for about 20 years with them. And we were in a place called Wellington near Palm Beach. And people called Weatherall that I worked for had a house on the same area as Springsteen. And I was just driving by one day, and he came out from between two cars on his bicycle. He had no shirt on, but I happened to see him in time. But he came out, and I just banged on the brakes and
clipped him.
Stopped.
Did he clip him?
Touched the bike, didn't touch him. Okay. But he did apologize and was very kind.
Look, that was your brush with him. And for people, I suppose, around about my age too, one of the TV shows that I've been reared with, although it was slightly before my time, was Hawaii Five-0. And interestingly, I actually remember Tom Selleck on Hawaii Five-0 because I think he was doing his own show at the time, and I think there was something of a crossover or something. I can't remember, but I remember reading a story about this separate to what we're going to talk about now. So what happened there?
Oh, you mean the incident with Tom Selleck?
The moustache.
They were filming the scene of along Kahala Avenue, and Mr. Mackley had a house rented on Kahala Avenue. And I had been to the supermarket and was on the way back, and I saw all these people lying along the road, but it meant nothing to me. But I came down a little side street and there was nobody stopping me, and I drove right out. The next thing I heard this car flying by as I cut out. It was Selleck and I think it was an Aston Martin or Lamborghini, I'm not sure. But he was furious that the scene was spoiled. He had to redo it again.
Because of?
Me. Because I came out on the scene and the police gave me a
You took the wrong turn or something, obviously.
No, I didn't take a wrong turn, but there was nobody there to stop me from coming out. It was like coming out on a rally's site and not knowing it.
They didn't keep you in. You didn't make the cut then. So that's on the cutting room floor somewhere, right?
Didn't make the cut, no. Okay. But James Lord, who was in Hawaii Five-0,
yep.
I'm sure you heard of him.
Yeah. He was the head guy, wasn't he?
He was the top, yeah.
Yeah, the lead, yeah.
And he used to come for dinner regularly. And I often had to drive him home.
Mm.
Yeah, he liked his little drink.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so there's plenty of chats there that he can't remember, but you can.
Yes.
In 80, like, because, I mean, obviously we're talking about, you know, it started off as sort of, would you call it a business, an employee-employer. Mr. McLennan's death in 86, having spent so long with him, having travelled so much with him and presumably gotten to know him, How did his passing affect you? Was it sudden? Did you know it was coming? And you know, what did that mean? That what did that mean for you beyond sort of, you know, having to seek alternative employment?
Oh, it was very traumatic to me. It happened very suddenly. He went to have a bypass operation.
Yeah.
He thought it was very routine. We had been to Hawaii in 86, and we got back in March, and the operation was planned for April. And he had plans made for the summer. We were going to Salzburg again that year. And he thought of even visiting Glenveagh, even though it was no longer in his hands. But my sister was trying to encourage him to come back to Glenveagh. And he went in for a triple bypass, and he got a stroke during the operation.
Wow.
And he lived about 2 weeks. But it was certainly a big change in my life.
And that change would have been almost instantaneous, I presume. Obviously, there's a grief there. There's a loss. But professionally, that was your job. It wasn't that there were other people within the family or what have you. Was that you effectively out of work?
Well, there, yes, because the house was, the contents were given to the museum and they kept what they wanted. That was the conditions of the will, as you would see in that book. Museum got their whole art collection worth about 100 million. And they got all the other furnishings from the house, but not the house. The house
and did he have no one to leave?
He had four nephews.
Yes.
And
was it his will to have this stuff distributed so that it could be enjoyed by the public?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So that was his plan.
So his collections at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, if you ever get to Philadelphia. And the nephews got the value of the house. It was sold for about 4 million eventually.
So they did okay, but he wanted this to return to, was that the type of he was? You know, he didn't want to hoard it. He wanted to return to public enjoyment.
No, people were trying to encourage him to make it a little private museum, but he's against small private museums. So he gave it to the museum where he was employed all his life, or worked. He was curator of the arts there, and he was also chairman of the board.
So when he passed away, you talked of then working for another 20 years with another family. Was that out of sort of necessity or desire? Did you like? I mean, obviously, a young man. Is that the type of work that you wanted to do? Did you want to continue the lifestyle? Did you want to stay out in the sun? You know, what was your motivation at that time?
Out of necessity, I had to work to make a living.
Yeah,
I didn't have enough money to live on.
That's why I'm still doing this.
Yes.
And because of it has to be a lot of dedication to do what you did. Because you have to take the highs and the lows. How did that factor into sort of, you know, forming relationships, making friends? Because you're here 1 month, you're there another month. You know, how did that work for you, or was it difficult?
It was difficult at times, but you tried to keep your friends the best you could. You had friends here in Philadelphia, friends in Philadelphia, and friends in Donegal when I was here in the summer. And still kept up the relationships.
What did they think of you, though? Because, I mean, you know, you would say to them, you know, how was Donegal? And you know yourself, right? You've got all this stuff. How did your friends treat you? I suppose very quickly, we're very good here at making sure we don't lose the run of ourselves, don't we? We bring people back down to earth with quite a bang sometimes.
Well, you need to come down to whatever level is happening around you. They're no good in being away up there in the sky.
No, because isn't it? You'd be nice to the people on the way up because you're going to meet them on the way back down again.
Correct. Yes.
So whilst it was still an important part of your life, was the next job that you were doing for the next 20 years much less remarkable?
Much so less, because I had to do everything in there. Like there was no big. Help there, like
they were obviously well-to-do, but not well-connected as such, or
yeah, they weren't the same sort of society.
did you miss then the lifestyle? Because no matter what your personality, there you're going to become accustomed to a way of life, aren't you? And this would have been a change in your way of life.
Oh, a huge change. And I had to drive 25 miles every day to get to work.
Mm.
And it was a whole different change.
When did you return home then? To Donegal. Sorry,
I still live in Philadelphia part of the year. Yes.
Right, okay.
I spend the winters there. I spend the summers in Rathdonald, which is right the road.
And that's just the perfect balance for you, right?
I think so, yeah.
And why don't you stay in Philadelphia all year round? What is the that draws you back here for this time of year?
I have twin daughters who are married to two Donegal men.
Good stuff. Do you know, so much of the time we talk about it being in reverse, right, where moms and dads or granny and granddads feel they have to go out to Australia because that's where the kids are settled. Here's you in Philadelphia, having to come back to Donegal.
I have a son in Philadelphia, and he has two girls.
So with all of you talked of, the parties, the personalities, you know, I mean, you know, Earl Spencer, could he be any different to Andy Warhol? Were there rules about behaviour? Or did Mr. McElhinney play fast and loose? You know, I mean, were these dinner parties, you know, or did you have to turn a blind eye at times?
Oh, no, never had to turn a blind eye, no. There was rules and regulations and people behaved very well.
Very good.
But at the same time, the atmosphere was pretty lax.
Really. Yeah. Wasn't too snooty.
No, I wouldn't have thought so, no.
Right. And where did you meet your wife? You talk of your three children. Was that during your time in Florida or before that?
I met Noreen. She worked at Glen Bay.
Okay.
That's where I met her.
And you stuck it out?
Stuck it out all those years, 2-3 years ago.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. Obviously, other than, you know, family relationships, is there something that you hold closest to your heart of your working life, if I could put it to you like that?
Well, I'm not sure.
Is that your personality, though, is it?
That's my personality, I guess.
You're just a cool customer, I think. What do you do for fun now, Patrick?
Oh, just visiting my daughters and my grandchildren and going to watching and following Donegal. Went to the game on Belle Buffet on Sunday and hope to go to Croke Park next Sunday.
Yeah. And when you're in Philadelphia?
Well, my son is there and pick up his daughter from school and
just be a hands-on granddad, because it's tough work. You look back, your working life, it was tough life doing what you were doing.
Well, yes and no. There was no hard work, and it was quite rewarding at times.
Brilliant stuff. Okay, yeah. So you're back home now for a bit. Sorry, home. You're back in Donegal for a bit now. Hopefully you get another day out. We're recording this ahead of Donegal playing Dublin in round three of the All-Ireland Championship. We don't know by the time this goes out whether we could be All-Ireland champions or we could have been out after Sunday, but that's the wonders of sport. We simply don't know. Patrick, it's been absolutely lovely talking to you. And, you know, for many people listening, it's a really remarkable story. And it just so happens it was to a Donegal man, and we're pretty chilled here, we're pretty down to earth, so it's
for you.
It's almost as amazing as it was the people that you met. They're just regular folk to you, aren't they, really?
Yes, pretty much so, yes.
All right, well, Patrick, thanks so much for joining
us. You're very welcome, Greg.
And a big thank you once again to the legendary Patrick Gallagher. Now, don't forget, if you enjoyed this podcast, we've loads for you to listen back to, some fantastic guests, all available on the Highland Radio website. But you can also search the Greg Hughes podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And any feedback, you can email the researcher and producer, that's Caroline Orr, and her email address is carolineorr@highlandradio.com. We'll be back with another episode next week.